Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You are listening to Fields, the podcast, with Melissa Metrick and Wythe Marshall.
On Fields, we bring you stories about the future, present, and past of urban agriculture, and in general, explore really interesting concepts and meet lots of fascinating people who get up every day and grow food in and around cities, starting with the city we live in, New York City.
Moreover, we'll investigate all the whys behind getting up in the morning and working as a farmer in the city today.
Just generally, your interest in growing and how you got excited about that, that's always like my first question. And I think Melissa's, you know, usually asks that. And then also just, yeah, what you're working on now and what university is up to. And the best way to say it, because I feel like I always say university, and I think it's meant to be university, right? Like,
yeah, that's it's a bit of a tongue twister for some folks. So they're just like, or they get confused and it's like, university of what? And I'm just like, no, this it's a play on words. many people have thought that I was with Cornell because they were like, oh, you're with the big university. And I'm like, not exactly. That's not what I'm saying, but we'll get there. So my name is Alexis Mena. I identify as Afro-Taino, and that's really the origins of my farming story. I come from a Dominican-Haitian background and from the island of Haiti, which is the original name for that island currently known as Haiti and Dominican Republic. And so the reason why I identify as Afro-Taino and not Afro-Latino is because I come from both Black and Indigenous backgrounds of the island. And I don't believe that Latinidad or the identity of Latin folk is based on anything other than colonization. So I purposely identify as that to push at my people to find new identities for ourselves. But within that, I grew up in a lineage of people who are merchants, farmers, and what we call curanderas, which are medicine folk. My grandmother's a curandera, my grandfather was a merchant, his grandfather was a farmer, and so on and so on. And so my grandfather taught me how to grow coffee and cacao since I was a kid, and he invited us on to his farmland since very young. And my grandmother, my family's favorite game is like identify that plant, like walk through meadows and like play that game, like what plant is this? It was the thing that became entertaining outside of television or board games at that, or Nintendo 64 or whatever was there. At that time, I took it for granted because I just thought it was just like this thing we would do as a family and not necessarily being vital information. Now I recognize that like I can forage with the best of them because I know what's what. But it's something that where, you know, sometimes you don't necessarily gain appreciation for that knowledge until you come to a different age and you realize why it was entrusted with you. So I'm very thankful and feel very privileged to have this experience. And my grandmother was actually, I don't identify as a man. My pronouns are they and them. And my grandmother was the first one to help me understand my identity as a two-spirited person. Obviously, I'm very masculine presenting, but there's another part of me that chooses and intentionally builds my divine feminine energy. And a lot of that is through my farming practice and through my work with the land, creating plant medicine. And so, you know, I was basically supporting my grandfather with livestock and with cacao and coffee growing in his farm, and then going back home during the summers while I was in DR, and then supporting my grandmother with her curanderia work. So both of them were big influences on me, and that's really where the beginning of my farming started. In America, it started actually in a lot of the Green Thumb community gardens. My mother was a garden member, and that was often our playground. Like, you know, I lived in East New York my entire life in this big park called Highland Park, which is a really big park, and, you know, it's comparable to, like, Prospect Park and stuff like that. But inside of it, there's a garden. And so she was a member, and we constantly were in the park, in the garden, and, you know, intertwined in both of those worlds. And so, you know, it was kind of like my chore. Our chores were to take care of this box to make sure we can eat tomorrow. It was not necessarily something I looked forward to again, but it was something that I now appreciate, those lessons that my mother and my grandparents entrusted in me as well. And so from there, I completely did an about face. I became a capitalist. My mom started, she got her real estate license. I decided to do the same. And I was doing real estate and mortgages. I also became a loan officer for a while, for about 6 years or so, right after high school, because I was working under this false narrative that farming is something of the past or a hobby, but not a career of the future. And that's how it was presented to me. But my actual first experience with hydroponic farming was actually when I was 14. I got into the state science fair, and I didn't think, like, you know, the baking soda vinegar volcano was going to cut it on that level. So I was doing research, and I decided to build a tomato box. And it was a box to do a Dutch bucket system, which is a hydroponic type of system. And, you know, my stepfather at the time helped me build it out of wood, install the lights, and install the system. And I was able to win second prize in the state science fair when I was 14 with this tomato box.
Wow.
Which I never actually successfully grew tomatoes because I only had blue lights and I didn't understand light spectrums at that time enough to understand I needed more red and yellow lights to actually get fruit. But hey.
14. You know, come on. Be easy on yourself. 14. You know? Come on. I mean, hey, second best, you know?
We made it happen either way. Thankfully, I now identify as a reformed or former capitalist, because when I got out of doing that work in real estate and mortgages, I still I was very thankful of understanding and getting financial literacy and understanding how land and how property works in New York City, which is like a gold mine in itself, right? And so I take that knowledge now to my community, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But basically, I'm what's known as a placemaker. I prefer the term placekeeper, but, you know, my placemaking work looks like identifying vacant lots, working with community members, and then converting those lots into gardens. So I've successfully built five community gardens, 3 school gardens, and 2 skate parks. I learned this ability from my mentor, Paula Hewitt, who ran a program by the name of Open Road. And her thing was like building skate parks all around the city. And so I watched her do it. She was actually she was part of the cohort of people who were squatting in the LES over on 12A and in Alphabet City. And so that's where she got her knowledge of like how to take over land, how to take over property. And she entrusted that information to me and a few other skaters at the time. And little did I know that I was going to be turning around and taking that to build community gardens, but here we are building gardens. Then at one point gardens weren't enough. Like, it was just not enough. I wanted to do more. So I ventured over to Northern California, Pennsylvania. I've done, you know, seasons in Rhode Island, and just got really immersed into farming and you know, when I turned after the age of 25, I felt this need to be more quiet. I grew up in the busiest, loudest town in the world my whole life. And I was a very vocal person, in case you haven't already noticed. And so, you know, I felt like there was a need to really get silent and really listen to the land and listen to what my ancestors were trying to communicate to me. So during that time, like I did about four seasons out away out of the state. And during that time, I was downloading a lot of information. I was, you know, praying and asking my ancestors to help me understand like what was next for me. You know, like at that point, I had already been a successful, you know, real estate agent. I forgot to tell you, but I'm also a muralist. So I was a successful muralist. I was able to create a career as a muralist. And now I was, you know, making strides as a placemaker. And I think that was right before I traveled to Amsterdam. I was asked to come out to Amsterdam to talk about my placemaking work at the Placemakers Conference, and was privileged enough to visit like a few different farms in Holland. And I saw how ag tech, how different it was, because ag tech was a really big part of farming in Holland, especially in Amsterdam and other parts, where people were doing a lot of cannabis growing and a lot of like growing of bell peppers and tomatoes for export, and how much they were relying on drones and cyborgs, but like robots to do a lot of that labor. And I was, a part of me grew a little fearful, because obviously these were white people developing technology that was going to displace black and brown people back at home eventually in the future, who were doing this job in a way that created further disconnection, and something that I believe is so important to have that connection to the land, to the food that we have. So not to say that we're opposed to ag tech. We actually develop ag tech at university, but we believe that ag tech should be an extension of the something that supports the farmer's intelligence and doesn't allow them to become dependent or lack in any way. So the moment that, you know, we introduce a piece of technology that then takes, for example, using the television, right? I would argue that people are maybe a little bit less imaginative in the world we live in today because of television. You don't have to imagine anything, because there's a whole industry based on imagining things for you and then presenting those images to you, right? So what does it look like? What would that look like in the farming world? What would it look like for us to become so far removed from our farming practices that we rely on technology to have that connection with the land, that we now further devalue the respect and the work that we do with the land and the connection with the land? When we're in a time right now when it's even more important to further that relationship and to bring that relationship even deeper, to make sure that we survive.
Alexis, can you talk about how you would actually use that technology?
Sure, yeah. So a lot of it right now is around monitoring. And the reason why we're focusing on monitoring, so such as water sensors, air quality sensors, and things of that nature, is because one, it's a really easy way to introduce people into programming and how to reprogram Raspberry Pis and small computers to create their own sensors. And in the black and brown community, there's not enough of that. There's not enough, you know, we don't have coding academies. We don't have fab labs where people can learn how to do these things. But the moment that you can prove to someone that it's simple to create this kind of sensor, now they become curious as to what else they can do. And these sensors, along with the education of how to build them, the reason behind them a lot of times is the environmental racism that happens in our communities, right? A lot of the time we have poor air and water quality in black and brown communities because of the industrial, the national or global epidemic of race-based, you know, propping of businesses primarily in black and brown neighborhoods. And so I'm a firm believer that a part of this BLM movement, part of this reparation movement, part of the back to the land movement, is for us to create the technologies necessary to combat this environmental racism and to create solutions. I think there's a huge future in that, right? There's a huge future in us using technology to solve the problems of the people who experience them by the people who experience them, right? Because who knows the solution better than the people who are actually going through it themselves? And so, you know, that to me is where I hope ag tech and green tech can really come into communities of color to support us freeing or liberating ourselves from these institutional errors that have been created prior to us. While it's not necessarily problems that we've created for ourselves, but they are problems that we need to solve because no one's going to solve them for us.
Yeah, or they think they're solving it, but they're not, like, you know, it's yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of where my mind goes is, like, have you seen, can you speak to successes or things in New York that have inspired you in that direction or things you're drawing upon? Maybe that's by way of saying, you know, where you're at now with this model. Like, I love everything you're saying about, like, how ag tech could be used differently, not just in a way to make money, by replicating the ag system we already have where a few people are controlling most of those decisions, but giving more tools out, having people more connected to their food in different ways. But yeah, I'm just curious, you know, you mentioned Green Thumbs. Are there other groups that are really great or that you're working with? And, you know, yeah, like, how does that led you to what you're up to today?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. The decentralization of power and of industry is super important, right? That's how we got into a world of monocropping and mass industrial agriculture, was these people working in silos and commodifying and looking at crops as an export instead of seeing the value it brings to communities when you have clean, fresh food, right? So now we have places like Chile and Uruguay that export more food than they have in their country, and those same people aren't even privy to getting the finest quality food that they're even producing inside of the country, right? So imagine how terrible it would be if we started 100 urban farms in Brooklyn and less than 1% of that is going to the communities of color who need that food most, right? So that's terrifying. Some of the organizations that we're working with in regards to that is Key Tech Solutions, which is one of the members here at University City, who's helping us develop networking and sensors, right? So a big part of what we're doing is, like, how do we create networking possibilities for urban farms across the city, right? So how are these farms talking to each other? How are they sharing information? You know, if wife can grow a tomato better than I can, and a lot of that, it comes down to the conditions in which he's utilizing in his system, then why can't that information be open source so I can replicate those conditions in my system so I can get that amazing tomato anyway, right? Because there's this scarcity model that's been built into farming, and that's problematic, right? We think that we're constantly in competition with it, even in the urban ag market right now, right? When I talk to other aquaponic or hydroponic farms, sometimes they're very reluctant to let you own the farm or give you too much information about their farm because they all consider it intellectual property, right? So with this IP movement of investors and angel investors and venture capitalists trying to buy people's intellectual property, people have decided that it is best to keep that information and all that data internally so they can then leverage it. Where I see that as a next wave of surveillance capitalism, right? Surveillance capitalism is now intertwining into our food systems, you know, where people have this scarcity mindset, they feel like they can't share. And I think the 3D printing industry is a great example of that, right? You had a whole industry of people saying all 3D printing and 3D printing technology should be open source. And you had other sector of people saying absolutely not, this is intellectual property, private as possible, right? Ultimately, we know who won that fight. But I think that, like, the same fight is happening right now in agriculture, where people are willing to talk about permaculture and biodynamic farming when it comes to nonprofit farms. But the moment you mention as a for-profit farm, people are not so willing to share that information and kind of cut you out of the conversation.
I think you hit the nail on the head with IP. I mean, I think that's so interesting that these farms view everything they're doing as intellectual property and the language that creates. Like, at the same time, people will tell me that their farm is about some kind of justice project, but also that it's IP. And it's like they don't understand the sort of inherent contradiction that, like, the idea of kind of private property at all, but especially, you know, then moving into these different, you know, ethereal registers where, like, your ideas can be commodified, you know, can be owned by corporations, that might be in conflict with some sort of justice project and more equitable world. It just seems like it is this there is this tension right now within a lot of ag tech companies where I feel like people want to do something good, but they see themselves as needing to participate in this tech world economy and thus create IP, defend IP. And I do think it's exactly as you're playing out. It's like you can see how this worked again and again with computing and those technologies, you know, 3D printing, et cetera.
I want to call it out, Wyeth, and I think that it's something that needs to be said. It's pandering. You know, a lot of the times these organizations are pandering and saying that, oh, we're a social enterprise. We have this social justice model because they know that that's what people want to hear. And that's what makes people more open to willing to buy this product at the end of the day. But there's no absolute truth behind it. You know, you can't say you're for the people and then say, well, you have to pay this to get into the door. You know, like,
it stops
being for the people as soon as you try to make a profit off of them. And that's where university differs. You know, what we're looking, what's food sovereignty to us looks like is creating economic mobility inside of the communities that need the food, and they're the ones controlling the food system. So if the people who are in most need aren't the ones growing and aren't the ones directly benefiting from that food, then there's no food sovereignty in your movement. There's no community control of it. You're just creating a private entity and shifting the dependence from one system to the other. You know, what we're looking to do is create an interdependent system that allows people to have a playground and a space to come up with ideas and come up with the innovations themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, what we are is an incubator space for ag tech and for food businesses so they can then figure it out, you know, because that's what we don't have right now, especially people of color. We don't have places to go and make mistakes. You know, we don't have a place to go and be able to and figure it out for ourselves. It's right now it seems like you have a startup. You figure out what your IP is, and then once you have a model that you can sell to an investor, the investor comes and floods you with dollars, right? But at the end of that, what they're saying is that this is the down payment so that we have the rights over the future profits, right? So that they're giving you $20 million today so that they can have that $20 billion that you're going to generate 10 or 20 years from now. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying to people is that, like, if we can raise the capital to figure out how to maintain the space today, then we can figure out how to split that $20 billion tomorrow and it be a cooperative movement, you know? And that's why we base ourselves in social enterprise and cooperative business practices, because we don't believe that centralizing power under the university label is going to be empowering to us at all. If anything, all it does is further dependency onto now another system. I just want to mention that a huge, huge inspiration for this has been the book Winners Take All by Anand V. I don't want to mess up his name because he's an amazing author and I don't want to chop it up. But in the book Winners Take All, He gives us a warning. He says, you know, you have to be very careful of people who say, oh, we're billionaires and we're philanthropists and we're here to save the world. Don't trust those people, right? Because the reason is because, you know, I'm not the hugest believer in government and policy, but I do see the power of policy and government in places, right? Policy and government shifts society. And when we give billionaires and people who are saying that they're here to perform social enterprise, but it is only that, a performance, what we're doing is giving them the power over say in our society. Who's to say that Elon Musk and Bill Gates know better than you and I on how this world needs to change? They're not qualified. They have specialized in creating electric cars or creating this computer chip, but it doesn't mean that they're the best ones or the ones whose voice should be leading the conversation in topics on how to save the world. You know, if we want to talk about and invite him into a conversation about how to build the best electric car, hell yeah, I'm all for it. But we can't fool ourselves to believe that just because someone has been successful in creating a successful business means that now they have to be the authority on what philanthropy or what the future of a certain industry looks like. Because it's just going to be selling ourselves short. And it's just furthering the oligarchy that we're creating in our community, in our nation today.
Yeah, and it's also like the people that we pick as these symbols, like exactly what you're saying, like these, like we think that they have this intelligence and we put them on this pedestal or have them be the symbol, when it's like exactly what you said. It's like, yeah, tell me how electric cars work. That's great. You're doing great on that end. But yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. And also that's like, I mean, I know I shouldn't go there, but it's like, that's a huge problem of, you know, who our president is today. It's like, dude, like I don't know. It's just
no. Thank you for going there. I think like that's a great warning of what the rest of the world can look forward to. Because what happens when we have actors in these spaces where we need real people with real ideas, right? Like America needs right now a strong leader, and because we allowed ourselves to be fooled by this actor. Now here we are in the pandemic, losing tens of thousands of lives that should not have been played with in the beginning if we had someone who actually knew what they were doing in office. So it's a sad example of what we need to protect ourselves for the future.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to note that, like, Yuri Horowitz, I think, is saying you can't trust like the Elon Musks to save you from Trump or the Warren Buffetts to save you from the Musks. Like at some level, they're all very self-interested. To your point, they're also very narrowly, like, they don't really know what's best for everyone. It's not that much different from any other, you know, whether it's the craziest person in the room or the least crazy, but it's still that power being concentrated that you talked about earlier. I think you see that at high levels in like the US government, but also, yeah, like in agriculture. I mean, I think a lot of us are interested in the same, you know, like how do you decentralize systems or have systems where, you know, one person's not making the choices, even if they do seem like a decent person, it's like, why should they make so many choices for so many people? And how did we get to this point? You know, and I think like even just unraveling the history of it, like I've tried to learn that, and it's like so complex and touches on so many other aspects that just, yeah, it's amazing to see how it's all leapfrogged together to reach this point where so much wealth and, you know, so many decisions are made by so few. So, no, I really appreciate you going there. And yeah, I think it's totally appropriate to, like, we don't only have to talk about, you know, urban ag, meaning like community gardens or, you know, one hydroponic system. I think it is tied together. Why are these systems appealing? Why is there a need? So that's something I think, Melissa, you and I have asked a lot about, you know, like the root.
Yeah, I think it's really important for farmers to be in communication and be in conversation about both the macro and the micro, right? It's just as important to talk about what's happening on your land as it is what is to talk about what is happening collectively to the farming community, especially when Trump was campaigning on being the farmer's choice president, right? He was like campaigning on being like, oh, farmers trust me, I'm here for the farmers. And all too often he proved himself time and time again that that wasn't true. He was serving the interests of himself and the organizations that he presents while using farmers and using us as a tool to gain better relationships with China at the time.
Yeah, and how well did those trade deals work out for farmers, right?
Like, terrible. <That's> terrible.
Seriously, and COVID hit, and then they had to throw away all their produce. It's just like, you know, I don't.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. Travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Well, we talk about the politicization of farmer as a class of person a lot because everyone wants to support farmers. But what does that really mean? And who gets supported? They give away money, but it goes to generally the big farms. And when you look at especially farmers of color, who owns land and how that's, you know, land loss is like accelerated even under Obama. I mean, it's like it seems like such an, you know, in terms of like problems, like, wow, that's a low hanging fruit problem that I think a lot of people could get behind, like, doing something about, but it hasn't, it's obviously not going to happen with Trump, but, you know, you wonder, like, what would it take? And is it going to come more from, I don't know, like models, like you're describing, you know, is it about new models? It's about, I don't know. That's not really a coherent question, but
but also maybe it can tie in with, Alexis, like your work with, what were you calling it, with Paula Hewitt, the open road work with what is it called?
Placemaking.
Placemaking. So maybe that is where it could tie in with the idea of property and land. And can you explain placemaking a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Placemaking is a concept that came out, I think, in the 60s or 50s. And there were city planners and urban designers were trying to understand how to navigate urban environments during the time when there was like urban renewal, right? So there were all these, after white flight, there were all these spaces that were dilapidated and that were, you know, falling apart. But these were also central commercial spaces for people to do business and industrial and industry and things like that. So what they decided to do was create public and private partnerships to invest in spaces. And a lot of like the first, you know, you can say, some would say that Central Park was a big placemaking project at the same, because there was an entire village there prior to Seneca Village was a prominent village, a successful village that was in the middle of Manhattan. But because city planners decided, well, in order for this space to be successful in the long run, we need more green spaces, which means now we have to coincidentally displace all these black and brown people from their land. And it wasn't just black and brown people, it was also white, Italian, and Irish migrants there. But because they were of the poor class and they in some ways saw themselves in the same as people of color in those spaces, they were displaced, right? So the same thing, like White was just saying in regards to black farmers, when the idea of the concept of a black farmer was devalued, it was easier to take away land from them, right? Because now you have the American Gothic image in your mind of a white middle-aged farmer with his white wife, and you're saying that's what a farmer looks like, yeah. Right? So of course it's easy for us to take land away from a black farmer, because that's not what a farmer looks like. That's what a slave looks like, you know? So, and if we're anti-slave, that means that we're anti-black people farming. So these are like subconscious signals that we send to ourselves in the way that, like, you know, how do we shift these paradigms? How do we shift these falsehoods that we've created for ourselves in our society? And I'm sorry, I'm going to answer your question about what placemaking is.
This is great.
Yeah. But it's this silent collaboration of both industry and municipalities to work together in ways that outwardly facing are beneficial to the community, but often inwardly facing they're for selfish or for industrial reasons that aren't necessarily for the betterment of the community at all.
I think that's it's almost uncanny you mentioned that idea, because I feel like that's so much of my work is focused on is this idea of making land or making farmland in the city, and how, you know, indoor farms often claim to kind of make more land on the same, you know, horizontal footprint by going up. But I think a lot of that, to your point, it's a performative act to get certain people interested to seem green and futuristic. But it's not necessarily doing much in terms of like making place. It's making land without making anthropological place, like a place where communities are. And I think it's really interesting to think about what it does look like to make different kinds and keep, to your point, place keeping. Like, how do you keep a community where they have the physical space that is appropriate to them, you know, that they want? And what kind of collaborations emerge if you did have a good city government? Like, what actually would be a good way to work together and not always contested, you know? Like, I mean, these are just things I'm like thinking of. Sorry, Melissa, it looked like you.
Yeah, I mean, what you were saying, what the first thing that came up to me was like, how do you make land inside of a private building, you know, and private property when you have to pay rent and all this other stuff? Like, how is that land accessible? You know, so I always think about the point of having indoor places either inside the building or on the roof or something like that. And, you know, that is, you might have to rent that property. Whereas if it's a vacant land or something like that, I don't know why in my brain that seems like it might be a little bit more accessible. Or even like today I planted a tree pit, like a street tree pit, and like people walk by and everybody's like, oh, look what you're doing, you know? And so it's like, that is in itself kind of, you know, just the community could see it, could feel like, I don't know, just, but Alexis, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I've witnessed that. I've witnessed how, like, you know, just earlier today, a father and two little girls were walking past University and they saw that we were like full of plants, and their first, I was like, we have something called the community friendly fridge set up, and I was offering them like produce. Like, I was just like, hey, there's free produce there. You're welcome to just grab a bag, as much produce you want, no fee, no charge. And they turned around and told me like, produce sounds nice, but we want plants. And I wasn't expecting that at all, right? I was expecting them to be like, yeah, free carrots, free cabbage, free watermelon. That's dope. But, and not that they weren't open to that, but what they were asking for was to take a piece of this green, serene life that they saw that we were creating here, that they wanted a part of that for themselves, you know, which is why you have people stop you at that tree pit, is because they want a part of that for themselves. They want that, the tranquility and the healing that comes with working with the land to be able to take back home with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's the beauty of placemaking. That's the beauty of placekeeping, because now you can show people the value of what it is. That, you know, I think that, like, often, I'm a native New Yorker, born and raised in East New York, Brooklyn. And I grew up in a neighborhood where I walked past empty lots every day, and saw them as a problem. I didn't see the opportunity, you know. And then there were other people, some would call gentrifiers, coming to my community and seeing that as an opportunity. So I had to readjust my eyes. I had to look at this from a new lens to really understand what is that they're seeing that I don't see, you know, and what privileges do those people have that I don't, that they can turn around and turn and create something that would take me 50 to 100 years to create, you know? And then you have to really analyze. And I'm, Wife, I think this is a great thing for you to look at in your research that you're doing, is where are these urban farms located? And a lot of the times, who is the end user, right? So who's purchasing the food? So you'll find that, one, a lot of these urban farms are popping up in the most gentrified neighborhoods, neighborhoods that are quickly being gentrified. And then their end user, or who they're selling it to, is the same community of gentrifiers that are looking to displace those folk, right? So someone, a mother of two or three, wouldn't be able to pay $7 or whatever, $5 a head for a head of lettuce, right? But that's who these urban farms are appealing to. So the success of these rooftop farms and these indoor grow operations have been based on ushering in this new wave of gentrification. While we've gotten so much pushback, and we're just like, well, we want to serve the institutions and the communities that don't have those privileges. Where's the model for that? And everyone's kind of looking at us like, there's no money in that. And we want to push back. We don't believe that that is true. You know, like, one of the things that we're focusing on right now is we're working with Teams for Food Justice, Collective Fair, and University to create a snap box benefit, right? So, like, what is it? We're right now distributing about 1,400 boxes of free food on a weekly basis, thanks to City Harvest and to Green Top Farms. But we noticed that there was a whole working class of people who didn't feel comfortable taking this free box because they felt like they were taking away from someone else, or taking an opportunity from someone else. But they would be willing to contribute a few dollars to buy a box, right? So, and this is a little bit different from a CSA model, because we're showing up with the food prior to growing it. So what we're in the midst of doing is being able to create our own, you know, Fresh Direct for the hood. You know what I mean? Like, Fresh Direct doesn't come to Brownsville or East New York to deliver food. So if they're not going to come to us, then how do we build our own, you know? How do we create our own models that employ and that are owned by our own people, you know? Employees of Fresh Direct aren't going to benefit from the the derivatives or the money that's made in the future by Fresh Direct. But the models that we're looking to create, and like another example is Brooklyn Packers, who we work with, right? Brooklyn Packers mm-hmm. is a worker-owned cooperative. That means that if you're packing with them and you're on a on what is an entry-level position, you have just as much decision and decision-making power as the president of that company. One member, one vote, you know? I don't know any large organizations working with that kind of ideology because they put the power, both economic and political power, in the hands of their shareholders. And they disenfranchise their workers. So they have no problem taking on the labor and the benefits of that labor, but they're not willing to share the collective economic and political power that they generate through that labor with their workers. And I think that that's that's where capitalism has failed us. That's where we have created a huge deficit in our communities, and where you see people pushing back on a farming level, on a distribution level, on, you know, so many different levels of the food system, that people are just tired. They don't want to work the land with, unless they either own the land or they're getting, you know, profit sharing from the from what they're picking. And my response to that is right on. That's exactly what we should be demanding. That's exactly what we should be doing. Because if that were the case, then the indigenous people of this land and the black and brown hands that have been working this land for decades would be in positions of power. They wouldn't be having to beg for them for ICE to not knock at their door to stop harassing their families, because they would be landowners by now. They would be, you know, powerful business folk by now, and would have positions of power to be able to dictate what the future of this country is.
I'm so glad you said that. I mean, we've talked before. It's like, I feel like some people really love urban farming, but they're afraid of actually looking at the city and, you know, things like gentrification and the role that one might play, and that you know, it is a complex, it's like, you can't just have like a nice urban farm and not address anything else going on in the city. And I think it's so much more fruitful. I think it's more realistic long-term for sure to ask for the other way. You know, it's like, well, what would it look like if a community had more power over its land, over its food? Then what farmerizes, as opposed to like, oh, what would be a cool farm? Let me just drop it in. You know, let me shop around for real estate, right?
I think it's also just that exactly what you said, Alexis, the power of land, the power of property in this country. Like, you know, it's just that being a part of, you know, what's going on today, of just, for hundreds of years, you know, who has owned the land, and it's time. And that is part of the conversation of like, it's, that needs to end, you know, just in that sense. And the idea of ownership, right? Like how powerful that is. And I could understand like looking at it, like I've looked at a lot of vacant lots, and I'm coming from a totally different perspective. I'm probably coming more from like the gentrifier's perspective. But it's like, I've been a grower for a little while now. And I look at a vacant land and I'm like, that's a lot of work. I'm like, I don't know if I could do that work right now. Like I'm old now. Like, I don't know if I could do that work. I know how much work that is. And especially if me and a bunch of people convert that land or something, if we're going to lose it in a year, you know, if we're going to lose it in 2 years, and how many times do you want to go through that? How many times can you go through that? Like put that work into it and then lose it.
Yeah, three of the four community gardens that I started have been sold to HPD for development. So I know exactly how that feels. It's not a great feeling. And you know, it's also disappointing for the community, because now you've asked people to invest in this space and their time and attention, and now, you know, they have going up to replace it is a building that they can't afford, with apartments full of people that don't look or want to interact with them, you know? So it's, they're losing so much more. And a lot of the times I want us to hold the city accountable, because a lot of times the city is deceptive in saying, oh, here's this piece of land, create this community garden, create this thing. And what they're doing is they're trying to harness the energy and the focus and the beauty in this space to make it easier to sell to a developer, right? Because if you come up across a piece of lot that has, you know, three vacant cars that have been abandoned, a boat, and like, a, you know, reminiscence of a burning building, it's gonna be a lot harder for you to be able to sell that land to someone if you come, if you can tell them, hey, look, there's a community of people who've been utilizing and stewarding this land for 3 years, you know? And that's exactly what happened to us in Eastern New York several times.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, I could, and also just like the community space in general, it's like, that is where the community is gathering. That's where like people have, you know, birthday parties or like performances or like all this other stuff. And also it's just like, that's where my tree is that I planted that's like now 20 years old and I'm gonna lose it. You know, just that, the other interesting thing that, I don't know, in a lot of the interviews and growers that we've talked to, and I've been thinking about it more, is the idea of that we are, as growers and gardeners and farmers, we decide to work with these other beings, that plants are beings, you know, and what happens when we know we're going to lose them. You know, yeah. I think that's another, another weird level, but like, just
there's hey, they've proven that plants feel pain, you know, like there's literally like, you know, there's a science that proves that plants experience pain as well, you know, like there's a biological change. So like what I'm hearing you saying is there's two levels of trauma, one being experienced by the people and another one being experienced by the land, you know, like how do you think a child reacts when you take it from its home and rip it away from its roots, you know, and put it in a community that it doesn't belong in. It's the same thing a plant is experiencing when you're ripping it from its roots and not allowing it to grow in what they thought was fertile land for them to be able to continue to thrive. And in my own spiritual practice, you know, it's a major disrespect to the land. You know, there are some plants that are sacred to look after, rue, tulsi, and a few others, but all plants are considered sacred in being a steward, right? So when you participate in this sacred act of supporting the restoration of the land, you are imbuing your energy into that land. You're imbuing your prosperity, your hopes, your dream in with that seed, in with that plant. And it begins to, you know, some would say your electromagnetic energy is being put into that and is helping to support that plant, right? Because there's EC or one of the things that we monitor in aquaponic and hydroponic farming is your EC, your electrical conductivity, right? Which is often measured by how much salt is in there, right? But what we're not looking at is the electrical currents that are being bounced off of the mycelium, all the bacteria and all the plant matter that's happening. And so don't you think that when you bend down on your knees and your hands and you touch that plant, you're also exchanging electricity and light with that plant? And so I don't think we've done enough research and understand what our relationship is to plants. But in a lot of ways, we don't need to, because the moment you visit a botanical garden or you step into a garden, you feel it. It's a immediate sense of being able to open up and being able to breathe differently and interact differently with people. You know, I've been in the worst moods, and in the moment I get into land and put my hands in soil, I feel so much better. And I'm just like, oh, this is what I needed. Like, you know, like I thought I was hungry, but actually what I needed was like my feet in the grass for a while, you know? And it's a beautiful experience.
That kind of makes me think, like today I was riding my bike home and I rode through the park and it was so hot outside and I was under these huge trees, like the bike path went under these huge trees, and it was just like this cool air, and it was just this, I was like, man, this is where I need to be. Like just riding my bike through this, you know, huge patch of trees. And I was like, I almost felt like this is the answer in the way, not the answer to, I mean, it is the answer to climate change, but, you know, just that sense of it's, you know, outside in the sun, it was like 96 degrees. And then once I got to this place, it almost felt safer. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I you know, we are lucky enough to have received a 4-star rating today on Google. I got an alert a few minutes ago, and the only comment was, university is a safe place for me, you know, and like that meant a lot to us.
So like, what is university and how should we support you in what you're doing? And like, how can people connect, you know?
Thank you. So university is an aquaponic farm and an incubator space for food-based and ag-based businesses and creative businesses to be able to create a, or have space to be able to incubate their projects. So we have about 10,000 square feet inside of the East New York industrial zone, and we're looking to expand into 40,000 square feet to be able to provide a space for people of the community to create solutions, you know, to create solutions to the waste issues, to create solutions to the environmental issues, to create solutions to the food scarcity issues that we're all experiencing in this town. Because let's be honest, if COVID hit and the 18-wheeler stopped moving, there would have been a lot more of us dead right now, right? Our food system is completely broken. It works in codependent ways that are unsupportive of each other. And so that we have to do something about it. And I think COVID helped us understand what our strengths were, which is our connection to our community and our ability to be flexible and responsive and adapt to what the community needs were. So while we were fundraising for our farm, because it's not completely operational at this moment, we were focusing on education. So we were doing a lot of education programs. I was managing a hydroponic farm inside of a middle school for Teams for Food Justice. And so that's where I've been for the last couple of months while doing this work. But when COVID shifted, obviously the farm and the school had to shut down, and I fought to keep it open as a resource for the community. And since then, we've started a food distribution program of about 1,400 to 2,000 boxes of food on a weekly basis that goes out to Brownsville, East New York, and Bushwick. And primarily through City Harvest, Green Top Farms, Brownsville Multifamily Services, and a few other organizations that we work with to distribute that food. And so right now what university is focused on is that distribution, but getting on track to finish our farm, right? Because we are an aquaponic farm. Right now we're experimenting with starting or incubating, wrong word. We are breeding the first catfish that is for indoor farming in the Northeast region, right? So when you take a seed of red corn from California, you have to now get that seed to aggregate to the climate of the Northeast. You're going to be growing it in New York City. Same thing we're doing with this catfish. Catfish are primarily grown out in South Carolina, Mississippi, and the South. And what we're trying to do is acclimate the mixture of a channel catfish with the blue fin catfish to be able to grow successfully indoors inside of Northeast region. And so we're on our way to becoming a hatchery in collaboration with Salvation and Praise Seafood. Apart from that, we're developing our own makeshift or custom aquaponic farms, as well as working with We Are Earth and the Grow Box Co. to provide retrofitted shipping containers that house hydroponic farms similar to the ones used by Square Roots. But the difference that we're making is we're not trying to get to Mars with it. What we're trying to do is put it in the hands of the people of this community so that we can have living classrooms in every school. We can have hydroponic farms at every senior center and, you know, hydroponic farms at every hospital so that the carbon footprint and the nutrient density of the food being provided to these spaces is as high as possible, because the carbon footprint is as minimal as possible. And these people are being trained and being given the opportunity to both either own or operate these farms themselves. And so we entice you all and we ask you all to go to our GoFundMe page and contribute to our crazy goal of 250,000. We're only 23,000 in right now. But we really believe that if we get that 250K, we can start implementing and building the systems that we need in order to really be independent of, you know, banks or other institutions that are going to access to do things we don't want to do.
Yeah. I mean, 10%, that's not bad. Getting there.
Not bad. Not bad.
Not bad.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to start. And yeah, I mean, it's a crazy time to be raising money. Like, it's a pandemic. So yeah, definitely donate. And that's GoFundMe. And then we're looking for...
The name of the campaign is Grow Brownsville. So Universe City is the social enterprise in the incubator space, but Grow Brownsville is the cooperative that we're creating for people to join. So you can be a cooperative member of Grow Brownsville and be a worker owner that then learns and operates their own farm, whether it's internal inside of our property or whether it be external.
Oh, Alexis, thank you. The new like model, or not even, it's not even necessarily new, but I love what you're doing, bringing to New York, you know, this model of owning, operating, working on the farm, living with the community, you know, not having those things be so separate is really great. So thank you for making time. Melissa, do you have any last thoughts, questions?
No, just, yeah, thank you for making the time to speak with us. And this work sounds incredible. And so, yeah, we're really glad that we got to have you on and talk about it. And also ways that, you know, more people could hear about it and support it. And it's great. So thank you.
Thank you, guys. And I'll follow up on the email with a link to our GoFundMe.
Yeah, we'll put links in the episode notes. And yeah, we'll have to talk again soon, man. We'll make time.
Absolutely. And if I may, I can offer a suggestion. My friend Amber over here, who's a little camera shy, is also a Black farmer. You can find her at Amber Tam in Instagram. And she has a mission of converting 15 to 13 acres of the Great Lawn in Central Park back into a farm, recognizing the semblance of Seneca Village, which I spoke about earlier. So check her out. She does amazing work. And she works at Brooklyn Grange. So she's an active Black farmer right now.
Great. Thank you. Awesome.
Yeah, I love that project. That's such a cool idea. We will definitely, yeah.
Let's... Yeah, Amber, we're going to have you on. Sorry.
I'll send you guys some links to her work.
All right. Great. Thank you
so much.
Okay, thank
you. Guys.
Fields theme music is by Sam Tindall.
Our amazing producing engineer at Heritage Radio is Liam Werner. And another big thanks to Liam Werner for the music on this episode.
Fields is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.